So welcome everyone, and thank you for coming this morning. Before I begin, let me again, on behalf of all of us, say thank you to the people who come early, who clean, who set up, who clean the cushions and the bathrooms. It's nice we can just come in and settle in, but I want to certainly acknowledge the people in many ways who contribute to the maintenance of the center here. We are a totally volunteer organization, and we rely on the goodness of members and non-members to maintain it. This is really a community, and this is our home. And so I appreciate the people who take care of it. I also appreciate personally a number of the people in our community who are really just taking care of lots of things these days. I mean, I know there was a half day of mindfulness yesterday, which I heard when I came in today was quite well attended, and everything was quite good. But I realized I didn't even know anything about it. I mean, I think I knew that it was happening. I didn't know who was giving the talks or anything. And so that was quite wonderful for me. It made me happy to know that the community is growing in that way, and there are many more people taking care of things. I know there was a Buddhism or meditation and science a thing earlier in the week, a class on vegetarian cooking, lots of interesting things. Brian is working with his wake-up group for younger people. So again, there's just a lot, and there will be a lot more going on. And it's wonderful that, again, there's so much participation. And over the coming years, I hope more people who have interests and skills and competencies and knowledge in certain areas will feel happy to share them with the wider community. So before I begin the formal talk, I realized I usually used to start up more regularly taking questions. So let me just say, if there's anybody here, and please don't be shy, new or old, who has any questions about what we do here, the practices we did here this morning, or even more important, in your life, in your readings, in your study, in your practice, and your desire to bring the teachings and the practices into your life. To facilitate real healing, transformation. Sometimes it's not clear. The way is not clear. So if anybody has any questions. Yes, sir.
When you bow to the...
And your name is?
Oh, Dean.
Yes, Dean.
Thank you for having me. When you bow to the river, are you worshiping him?
Or yeah. So that's a good point. Many of us grew up in traditions where bowing before graven images or idols was a major no-no. So that's a good question, and probably in answering it, it's probably more subtler than we could imagine. For quite a while after the death of the Buddha in India, there were no representations of him. For a while, he was an historical figure that had not died too many generations ago, so he was still in the popular vernacular of his age. But over time, as people wanted to remember him more, the teachings, there were representations. And the early representations were things like lotuses, or like the Dharma wheel, which is representative of the teaching, footprints, imprints of his foot. and it was really quite interestingly, Buddhism spread quite widespread. We know about it spread in Asia, but it also spread countries like Afghanistan, into Iran, Pakistan, were strong centers of Buddhism. And it was in Buddhism's going west, and really encountering the Gandhara, the Greek civilization had also been coming east. And it was really the Greeks who were, as anybody goes to museums know, were quite wonderful in their representation of gods and human forms and other types of things. So it was really in the Gandhara, or in that movement of Buddhism out of India, west, and when it came across the Hellenic cultures, that the representations, and if you look at what we call a Gandhara Buddhas, they're very unique. As anybody's seen them, you will notice they have mustaches. You know, the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas all have mustaches, and they have long hair. They're quite, it's interesting. I mean, they look like Greeks, so to speak. But over the years, obviously, with the flowering of Buddhism in Asia, there was great artistic unfoldment and Buddha images, frescoes, paintings. I mean, you know, just were everywhere, not just in monasteries, caves, rocks. I mean, it captured the popular imagination and the artistic imagination. But what were they? Right. I mean, obviously, they are not, this is not the Buddha. So to empower that image with some kind of power or something, you know, and therefore it needs to be worshipped or propitiated, like an idol worship, is not the case at all. It is a representation, right? We are human beings. And we like to see, Buddha mind is for most people fairly abstract. You know, I mean, obviously we could have nothing up here. We could have a flower. We could have anything. We have representations of the Buddha because it reminds us, one, of there was a Buddha, an historical being, 2,600 years ago, who, was a human being like us, who came to full enlightenment, right? Full enlightenment means he realized the fullest potential of what it means to be a human being, and all the wonderful capacities of our mind were fully developed in him. Conversely, it means all the narrowness and afflictions and emotional disturbances of the mind were also eradicated. He was a Buddha. So, and Buddhism began with him. So it is a reminder of this connection. Sitting here on Nebraska Avenue in Tampa 2,600 years ago, that the fundamental insights that we are using in our own healing and transformation and practices are connected to this long tradition, 2,600 years, unbroken tradition, going back to the Buddha. But even again, so there's that historical connection, but it also reminds us that each of us, because a beautiful Buddha, and I think this is a beautiful Buddha, we looked for him for quite a while until he came our way. When we look at a well sculpted Buddha or well painted Buddha like this, there is a presence, right? Right. We see a being who is solid, who is whole, who is calm. You know what I mean? There's a certain quality. So just having a Buddha in the meditating with us, so to speak, is helpful. It reminds us, you know, I mean, we could be sitting here and our mind could be, you know, all over the place, or we could be fixated on something. And you look up and you see the Buddha sitting so serenely, right? Continually. He's always sitting. We could sneak in here at 2 a.m. in the morning just to catch him, you know, to see him. And he'd still be there like that. And that's a reminder that our true nature is like that, is always available to us. And there is this intrinsic wisdom and awareness always available to us. Now, that is not to say I just want to say this for full disclosure. What's your name again?
Dean.
Dean. So that is not to say, Dean, that over the 2,600 years of Buddhism in Asia, that some peoples, many peoples perhaps, began to invest more in the images than the teachings ever did. Right? And the same way human beings in all various types of religious traditions tend to fixate on religious icons and give them special energy, and therefore you know, do things that human beings, you know, have done for millenniums and millenniums, right? They propitiate the gods, right? Help me, intervene for me. And, you know, people do that too in kind of popular Buddhism. But what I spoke to you first is really what it's about. I mean, the Buddha was, you know, I mean, when people would say to him, when he was alive, you know, are you a god? You know, what are you? And he would always say simply, I am awake. I am awake. That's all. So good. Thank you, Dean. Any other questions? Please don't be shy. Again, but you know, please remember that Buddhism was in Asia for, as we said, 2,600 years. So, it many symbols that were in cultures were then taken and given new meaning. The lotus is a very popular image in Buddhism. It is a beautiful flower. And if you go to Asia, lotus pools, lotus gardens are very common. You know, you see lots of that everywhere. But in Buddhist temples and everything, they like to have lotus gardens. But the lotus has a unique meaning for Buddhism, besides just that it's a beautiful thing. Because the lotus, we see, when we look in the pond, we see this beautiful flower, right, on the water. What we don't see is what it's rooted in. And what it's rooted in is muck, you know, yuck, mud, you know, I mean, that's what it's rooted in. So it has this strange capacity that it is rooted, which means it gets its nourishment from muck, from yucky muck, stuff we don't like to step into. We step in the muck and it squishes and it feels yucky. People don't like it. And yet this beautiful lotus, this beautiful flower is rooted in it, and out of it grows, out of this muck. This yuck muck is transformed into this beautiful flower. So that really is why it's such a meaningful symbol for practice. Because many of us, or most of us, all of us, when we begin our real serious spiritual life, seeking for transformation, seeking to flower, right? Seeking to flower, to really flower as a human being, we begin where? We're in the mud. We're in the muck. That's the truth, you know, where our minds still are filled with afflictive emotions. We're still up and down. We still have all kinds of misperceptions. We're still, you know, all over the place, right? We're in the mud. You know, our mind is still very neurotic, you know, all this stuff, okay? So that's the mud. And if you don't understand the capacity that the mud of human afflictions, the mud of human sufferings, has the potential for transformation and becoming its opposite, right? You know, again, if you just came across the swamp and the muck you would say, you know, yuck, let me go somewhere else. But if you understand the capacity to grow lotuses in the mud, you go, wonderful, right? Muck is the perfect environment to grow lotuses, right? Okay. Which means it is our misperceptions, it is our suffering, it is our own pain and suffering and misdirection that fuels, that nourishes our desire to awaken and be free, right? So that is why we should never bemoan what has occurred in our life. We should never bemoan, why did this happen to me? Why is this happening to me? We should never get into that place of, oh, I'm so screwed up, I'm so neurotic, I'm such a mess. I could never, become a person of beauty. I could never be happy. I could never really be open-hearted. I could really never be free. We would never say that, because we understand that within the muck, the lotus flower grows. Nowhere else, right? Where do Buddhas come from? They come from people like us. They don't come from anywhere else. They don't come from the sky, right? They don't come from the sky. Buddhas appear from the mud of life. So it's a very powerful metaphor, the lotus in the mud. Good. are there any other questions? Yes.
In the recitation after the walking meditation, mm-hmm. the reference to the superiority complex, the inferiority complex, and the equality.
Yeah. What is that?
Exactly.
Yeah. What? Yeah. Usually when we hear that, we go, yeah. So the question is, in the recitation before the Dharma talk, there is the mention of the superiority, inferiority, and equality complex. I would imagine the superiority and the inferiority complex, you understand. That is in our Western psychological vernacular, right? We speak of people who have a superiority complex. They think they're better than everybody else. And then there are those who have inferiority complexes. They think they're worse than everybody. On one side there are people going, I'm better than everybody else, and then there's other people on the other side who are going, I'm worse than everybody else. So they're kind of made for each other, right? I mean, it's kind of a wonderful mirroring, and I guess if they run into each other in life, they could create a quite happy relationship. If there weren't other problems with those complexes. It is the equality complex that throws us, right? Because equality sounds pretty good to us, right? We think that's what it's all about. So this is not the equality of equal rights or justice for all. This is not that equality. And what that verse is talking to is really a key point of Buddhist psychology and understanding, is that intrinsically the sense that human beings have of their selfhood, of their ego, of their, that I'm a me, and this complete identification as a self, as a me, as an ego, is the root in Buddhist psychology, is the root of our suffering. It is what separates us and what causes us to stand outside of human experience and others, and look at life and relate to life from a certain kind of stance. It's not an openness, because there is this blockage with these complexes, this complexity of self. And so what's talked about is, when it says, may I be free of all the it's really saying, may I be free of all those complexes that self generates, right? because of causes and conditions, your self-made generators, I'm better than everybody else, right? I should be first online, right? I should win the lottery, right? I mean, I should get the raise, right? I shouldn't be caught in traffic, right? Because I'm somehow better than. You know, and then the other side, there are those who go, you know, look, no matter what happens, it's always me, right? Just I must deserve it, right? I'm always the one last in line. I'm always the one stuck in traffic. I'm always the one that gets passed over. There's something must be just intrinsically wrong with me, right? But then there are the equality, which is the interesting one, which is means, well, I'm as good as you, right? You know, I'm as good as you. I should be, you know, why should you get that? I get that. It's not from a stance of superior, like it should all come to me, but it's sort of like, I'm as worthy as you. But the truth is, we're not, are we? Right? Some people are smarter than us. Right? And some people aren't. Some people are more competent than us, and some people aren't. Right? Some people have better fortune than us. Right? Some don't. Right? So, the equality complex, I think, really eliminates all jealousy. You know, it's willing to live in the world and understand that we are not all equal, right? Somebody will win the Oscars, right? I mean, you could debate the worthiness of it, but the bottom line is somebody will win it, won't they, in each category. Because in the world of things as they are, choices are made. Right? Somebody may, you know, you go into the supermarket and lots of choices, right? Just because you choose one, it does not mean that the other is necessarily bad. But it also doesn't mean they're all equal, right? Are all cereals equal? No. They're different. Liberate cereals. So it's really a very key point when it says, you know, may we be liberated. It means, can we be liberated from all those views we have of ourself, which causes so much suffering, right? Because the one who thinks they're better than, everything should come to me. I should always be first. I'm the best. I'm smarter than, handsomer than, you know. And the one who's over on the opposite side, and the one who's always, why not me? Why not me? Why not me? Always jealous and always envious. All those are causes of suffering. None of those people are happy. None of those people are happy. And they're all separate from each other. They're all encased in their complexes of who they think they are and how they think life should be for them. And right? We want to free ourselves of all that. We want to be open and free. So may I be free of all those neurotic complexes of self that I've always identified with. Is that... Yeah, so that's what that's about. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, Evelyn. So that's the question is. I mean, it's really a two-part question. You snuck in the real meaning here. So the first part was, you know, Westerners, we sit in chairs. Is there a purpose in sitting on cushions the way we do? And then you added it, and especially when it is painful, does that even give us more reason? So again, the Buddhist tradition, the meditative tradition is really coming to us from Asia. And Asia traditionally sitting. Well, again, it is true that these were cultures where people did sit more on the ground, you know, just cross-legged or on small little cushions or whatever. People were more used to sitting on the ground just socially with each other, and meditators, when they sat on the ground, obviously to take a posture like the lotus posture, where your legs and knees are locked in and you have this solid base, right? It's a very solid base and a very a unified kind of posture, because the extremities, the legs and the arms, are all kind of brought together. So it has been traditionally thought that learning to sit, you know, in some sort of lotus posture in which the body is immovable, quiet, is an aid to quieting and calming the mind. And having grown up in the West, always sitting in chairs, and learning to sit on the floor in a cushion, I can agree that there is something very special on sitting by oneself on the ground in this stable, solid posture, not leaning on anything, upright, is I think quite wonderful. But having said that, that does not mean that one cannot stabilize the mind, calm the mind, and come to full enlightenment not sitting in a chair. I mean not sitting on a cushion. Okay. So this is just a tradition. Okay. But is it essential? No, because the most essential thing in meditation, the meditation has to do with the mind, right? There is a belief, again, that stabilizing and quieting the body helps quiet the mind. It's a further step. It's a good step toward. But as those of you who are sitting in chairs know, that can also be done in a chair or on a bench or whatever. So as for pain, you know, I think in relationship to learning, if you want to make the transition about just learning, if one what it's like to sit on the ground in a posture. And again, you will notice that traditionally in India, when you see people sit in lotuses, or posture meditation, they usually don't have anything underneath them. They usually sit on the ground. Cushions sort of developed as Buddhism spread. So if you go to Chinese Zen temples, you'll find smaller cushions. These larger ones, you tend to find more in the Japanese and Korean tradition. I mean, I don't know why. And again, that is because the cushion gets your butt up. It gets your butt up. When your butt gets up, your knees go down. And you want to have, you know, you don't want to be off balance. You don't want to do any damage to your spine. So the cushion, by getting your butt up and getting your knees down, kind of increases the stability that for most of us, without the cushion, we'd kind of be like that, or our knees would be up, you know. So getting more height underneath it. Because we don't grow up sitting on the floor, for most of us, it is an exercise in a certain degree of uncomfortableness, sitting on the ground. And that's just, I would say, at that level, it is just something that we go through, right? Probably other kinds of physical activities that we may exercise activities or other types of things that in the short run, before we are fully stretched and whatever, we may find more uncomfortability / a little bit of pain, but over time, right, will decrease. So again, there is a certain degree of uncomfortableness that usually we will encounter if we are wanting to make the transition to sitting on the ground. Again, it should not be excruciating pain. That's not what this is about. Again, speaking from my own experience, again, now, I mean, I began my meditative tradition in a very sort of austere tradition, where everybody was subtly, if not very overtly, encouraged to sit on the ground, on cushions, in the lotus posture. And moving was not allowed. Once you took the posture until the end of the round, at 35, 40 minutes, you were not allowed to move. If you moved, the monitor, this would be this lady over here, would go, "No moving." That would echo through the meditation hall, striking fear into the participants. So to be honest with you, my learning how to meditate and sit in the lotus posture was incredibly excruciatingly painful. I mean, I think I probably spent the first year praying for the bell. Which is a little bit of a distraction, but so I think that was a little extreme. But on the other hand, speaking in favor of that is, you know, again, speaking as a good American, we do not do well with discomfort, do we? We don't like to be uncomfortable, right? If it's a little too warm, we want to put the AC down. If it's a little too cool, we want to put it up, right? We pop pills for everything, right? I mean, you know, stomach a little of this, take of that. Headache a little bit of this, take of that. I mean, we do not like discomfort. We like to be comfortable. Again, which is, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. Except for many people, it is obsessive, because our suffering when we are uncomfortable is really quite disturbing to our calmness and well-being, right? In other words, we seem to, as we've acculturated over these past years, decades, we become less and less able to endure any type of discomfort or unpleasantness, and more we look for quick fixes, right? I think that is dangerous. Dangerous just in our own capacity as human beings to be comfortable and adaptable to life. You know, it's often uncomfortable. Has anybody ever noticed that? I don't know. You know, I mean, there are. You know, there's lots of just uncomfortable situations we get into. Not just the weather or climate or physical discomforts or, you know, personal discomforts, situations we're in, and we want to learn how to deal with these things by relaxing and opening rather than shutting down, making incredible dramas, or needing an instant fix. You know, what I learned in those early years of my Zen training was, no matter how excruciating it was, and no matter what drama I was making about the damage that I was doing irreparably to my body, or no matter how much begging or mental hatred I directed toward the bell master, asking Dean, you know, how many times I invoked the Buddhas to please, and you know, could you just move the clock a little bit, you know? When the round ended and I unfolded my legs, everything was immediately okay. And that whole big drama that I had distracted myself with was nothing but my own creation. And that's a good learning. So, as I say, when I look back at those early years, I certainly see it was extreme, because it did border on a little bit of pain for the sake of pain, and it kind of evolved into kind of a macho kind of practice, you know. Everybody was toughing their way through it and more focused on how tough they were than how realized they were, which is backwards. But again, I can see the benefits from having gone through that. So again, in terms of those of you who are learning to sit on the floor, you know, I think there's a lot to learn from discomfort. And meaning, watch your mind. You know, I mean, what are we experiencing? Sensations in our knees, right? That's all. Sensations in our back or neck, I mean, they're not killing us, are they? No. They're uncomfortable sensations in most of the cases. And watch what your mind does with it. The stories it creates, how you become totally focused and obsessive about it. And how, rather than learning how to relax and open, to give it space, we narrow and constrict, which makes it only worse. And we do that with this physical discomfort, but we even as well do it with our emotional and mental discomfort. We're in an uncomfortable situation, there's an uncomfortable interaction or something, and what do? Obsess about it, right? Obsess about it. Rather than relaxing, creating space around it so it can just pass through, we fasten onto it, make it the focus of our attention, and make ourselves miserable. So, please understand, sitting on the cushion, sitting in meditation, there's a lot to be learned on the journey. If you just watch yourself, see how you respond. Right? See the drama that you create. See the emotions that arise. So, it's only for the brave. Any other questions?